that perhaps we shall be better employed elsewhere. It may be that the police resented the intrusion of an amateur, or that they imagined themselves to be upon some hopeful line of investigation, but it is certain that we heard nothing from them for the next 2 days. During this time, Holmes spent most of his time smoking and dreaming in the cottage, but a greater portion in country walks, which he undertook alone, returning after many hours without remark as to where he had been. One experiment served to show me the line of his investigation. He had bought a lamp, which was the duplicate of the one which had burned in the room of Mortimer Tregennis on the morning of the tragedy. This he filled with the same oil as that used at the vicarage, and he carefully timed the period which it would take to be exhausted. Another experiment which he made was of a more unpleasant nature, and one which I am not likely ever to forget. "You will remember, Watson," he remarked one afternoon, "that there is a single common point of resemblance in the varying reports which have reached us. This concerns the effect of the atmosphere of the room in each case upon those who had first entered it. You will recollect that Mortimer Tregennis, in describing the episode of his last visit to his brother's house, remarked that the doctor, on entering the room, fell into a chair? You had forgotten? Well, I can answer for it that it was so. Now, you will remember also that Mrs. Porter, the housekeeper, told us that she herself fainted upon entering the room, and had afterwards opened the window. In the second case, that of Mortimer Tregennis himself, you cannot have forgotten the horrible stuffiness of the room when we arrived, though the servant had thrown open the window. That servant, I found upon inquiry, was so ill that she had gone to her bed. You will admit, Watson, that these facts are very suggestive. In each case there is evidence of a poisonous atmosphere. In each case, also, there is combustion going on in the room. In the one case, a fire, in the other, a lamp. The fire was needed, but the lamp was lit, as a comparison of the oil consumed will show, long after it was broad daylight. Why? Surely because there is some connection between three things: the burning, the stuffy atmosphere, and finally the madness or death of those unfortunate people. That is clear, is it not?
It would appear so.
At least we may accept it as a working hypothesis. We will suppose, then, that something was burned in each case which produced an atmosphere causing strange toxic effects. Very good. In the first instance, that of the Tregennis family, this substance was placed in the fire. Now, the window was shut, but the fire would naturally carry fumes, to some extent, up the chimney. Hence, one would expect the effects of the poison to be less than in the second case, where there was less escape for the vapour. The result seems to indicate that it was so, since in the first case only the woman, who had presumably the more sensitive organism, was killed, the others exhibiting that temporary or permanent lunacy which is evidently the first effect of the drug. In the second case, the result was complete. The facts, therefore, seem to bear out the theory of a poison which worked by combustion. With this train of reasoning in my head, I naturally looked about in Mortimer Tregennis's room to find some remains of this substance. The obvious place to look was the talc shelf, or smoke guard, of the lamp. There, sure enough, I perceived a number of flaky ashes, and round the edges a fringe of brownish powder which had not yet been consumed. Half of this I took, as you saw, and I placed it in an envelope.
"Why half, Holmes? It is not for me, my dear Watson, to stand in the way of the official police force. I leave them all the evidence which I found. The poison still remained upon the talc, had they the wit to find it. Now, Watson, we will light our lamp. We will, however, take the precaution to open our window to avoid the premature decease of two deserving members of society, and you will seat yourself near that open window in an armchair, unless, like a sensible man, you determine to have nothing to do with the affair. Oh, you will see it out, will you? I thought I knew my Watson. This chair I will place opposite yours, so that we may be the same distance from the poison and face to face. The door we will leave ajar. Each is now in a position to watch the other and to bring the experiment to an end, should the symptoms seem alarming. Is that all clear? Well, then, I take our powder, or what remains of it, from the envelope, and I lay it above the burning lamp. So, now, Watson, let us sit down and await developments. They were not long in coming. I had hardly settled in my chair before I was conscious of a thick, musky odour, subtle and nauseous. At the very first whiff of it, my brain and my imagination were beyond all control. A thick, black cloud swirled before my eyes, and my mind told me that in this cloud, unseen as yet, but about to spring out upon my appalled senses, lurked all that was vaguely horrible, all that was monstrous and inconceivably wicked in the universe. Vague shapes swirled and swam amid the dark cloud bank, each a menace and a warning of something coming, the advent of some unspeakable dweller upon the threshold, whose very shadow would blast my soul. A freezing horror took possession of me. I felt that my hair was rising, that my eyes were protruding, that my mouth was opened, and my tongue like leather. The turmoil within my brain was such that something must surely snap. I tried to scream, and was vaguely aware of some hoarse croak which was my own voice, but distant and detached from myself. At the same moment, in some effort of escape, I broke through that cloud of despair and had a glimpse of Holmes's face, white, rigid, and drawn with horror, the very look which I had seen upon the features of the dead. It was that vision which gave me an instant of sanity and of strength. I dashed from my chair, threw my arms round Holmes, and together we lurched through the door, and an instant afterwards had thrown ourselves down upon the grass plot and were lying side by side, conscious only of the glorious sunshine which was bursting its way through the hellish cloud of terror which had girt us in. Slowly it rose from our souls like the mists from a landscape, until peace and reason had returned, and we were sitting upon the grass, wiping our clammy foreheads, and looking with apprehension at each other, to mark the last traces of that terrific experience which we had undergone. "Upon my word, Watson," said Holmes at last with an unsteady voice, "I owe you both my thanks and an apology. It was an unjustifiable experiment, even for oneself, and doubly so for a friend. I am really very sorry." "You know," I answered with some emotion, for I have never seen so much of Holmes's heart before, "that it is my greatest joy and privilege to help you." He relapsed at once into the half-humorous, half-cynical vein which was his habitual attitude to those about him. "It would be superfluous to drive us mad, my dear Watson," said he. "A candid observer would certainly declare that we were so already before we embarked upon so wild an experiment. I confess that I never imagined that the effect would be so sudden and so severe." He dashed into the cottage, and reappearing with the burning lamp, held at full arm's length, he threw it among a bank of brambles. "We must give the room a little time to clear. I take it, Watson, that you have no longer a shadow of a doubt as to how these tragedies were produced?"
"None whatever."
"But the cause remains as obscure as before. Come into the arbour here, and let us discuss it together. That villainous stuff seems still to linger round my throat. I think we must admit that all the evidence points to this man, Mortimer Tregennis, having been the criminal in the first tragedy, though he was the victim in the second one. We must remember, in the first place, that there is some story of a family quarrel followed by a reconciliation. How bitter that quarrel may have been, or how hollow the reconciliation, we cannot tell. When I think of Mortimer Tregennis with the foxy face and the small, shrewd, beady eyes behind the spectacles, he is not a man whom I should judge to be of a particularly forgiving disposition. Well, in the next place, you will remember that this idea of someone moving in the garden, which took our attention for a moment from the real cause of the tragedy, emanated from him. He had a motive in misleading us. Finally, if he did not throw the substance into the fire at the moment of leaving the room, who did so? The affair happened immediately after his departure. Had anyone else come in, the family would certainly have risen from the table. Besides, in peaceful Cornwall, visitors did not arrive after 10 o'clock at night. We may take it, then, that all the evidence points to Mortimer Tregennis as the culprit. Then his own death was suicide. Well, Watson, it is on the face of it a not impossible supposition. The man who had the guilt upon his soul of having brought such a fate upon his own family might well be driven by remorse to inflict it upon himself. There are, however, some cogent reasons against it. Fortunately, there is one man in England who knows all about it, and I have made arrangements by which we shall hear the facts this afternoon from his own lips. Ah! He is a little before his time. Perhaps you would kindly step this way, Dr. Leon Sterndale. We have been conducting a chemical experiment indoors, which has left our little room hardly fit for the reception of so distinguished a visitor. I had heard the click of the garden gate, and now the majestic figure of the great African explorer appeared upon the path. He turned in some surprise towards the rustic arbour in which we sat. "You sent for me, Mr. Holmes. I had your note about an hour ago, and I have come, though I really do not know why I should obey your summons." "Perhaps we can clear the point up before we separate," said Holmes. "Meanwhile, I am much obliged to you for your courteous acquiescence. You will excuse this informal reception in the open air, but my friend Watson and I have nearly furnished an additional chapter to what the papers call the Cornish horror, and we prefer a clear atmosphere for the present. Perhaps, since the matters which we have to discuss will affect you personally in a very intimate fashion, it is as well that we should talk where there can be no eavesdropping." The explorer took his cigar from his lips and gazed sternly at my companion. "I am at a loss to know, sir," he said, "what you can have to speak about which affects me personally in a very intimate fashion." "The killing of Mortimer Tregennis," said Holmes. For a moment I wished that I were armed. Sterndale's fierce face turned to a dusky red, his eyes glared, and the knotted, passionate veins started out in his forehead, while he sprang forward with clenched hands towards my companion. Then he stopped, and with a violent effort he resumed a cold, rigid calmness, which was perhaps more suggestive of danger than his hot-headed outburst. "I have lived so long among savages and beyond the law," said he, "that I have got into the way of being a law to myself. You would do well, Mr. Holmes, not to forget it, for I have no desire to do you an injury." "Nor have I any desire to do you an injury, Dr. Sterndale. Surely the clearest proof of it is that, knowing what I know, I have sent for you and not for the police." Sterndale sat down with a gasp, overawed for perhaps the first time in his adventurous life. There was a calm assurance of power in Holmes's manner which could not be withstood. Our visitor stammered for a moment, his great hands opening and shutting in his agitation. What do you mean?" he asked at last. "If this is bluff upon your part, Mr. Holmes, you have chosen a bad man for your experiment. Let us have no more beating about the bush. What do you mean?" "I will tell you," said Holmes, "and the reason why I tell you is that I hope frankness may beget frankness.
What my next step may be will depend entirely upon the nature of your own defence.
My defence?
Yes, sir.
My defence against what?
Against the charge of killing Mortimer Tregennis.
Sterndale mopped his forehead with his handkerchief. "Upon my word, you are getting on," said he. "Do all your successes depend upon this prodigious power of bluff?"
"The bluff," said Holmes sternly, "is upon your side, Dr. Leon Sterndale, and not upon mine. As a proof, I will tell you some of the facts upon which my conclusions are based. Of your return from Plymouth, allowing much of your property to go on to Africa, I will say nothing save that it first informed me that you were one of the factors which had to be taken into account in reconstructing this drama.
I came back.
I have heard your reasons and regard them as unconvincing and inadequate. We will pass that. You came down here to ask me whom I suspected. I refused to answer you. You then went to the vicarage, waited outside it for some time, and finally returned to your cottage.
How do you know that?
I followed you.
I saw no one?
That is what you may expect to see when I follow you. You spent a restless night at your cottage, and you formed certain plans, which in the early morning you proceeded to put into execution. Leaving your door just as day was breaking, you filled your pocket with some reddish gravel that was lying heaped beside your gate.
Sterndale gave a violent start and looked at Holmes in amazement.
You then walked swiftly for the mile which separated you from the vicarage. You were wearing, I may remark, the same pair of ribbed tennis shoes which are at the present moment upon your feet. At the vicarage you passed through the orchard and the side hedge, coming out under the window of the lodger Tregennis. It was now daylight, but the household was not yet stirring. You drew some of the gravel from your pocket, and you threw it up at the window above you.
Sterndale sprang to his feet. "I believe that you are the devil himself!" he cried.
Holmes smiled at the compliment. It took two, or possibly three, handfuls before the lodger came to the window. You beckoned him to come down. He dressed hurriedly and descended to his sitting-room. You entered by the window. There was an interview, a short one, during which you walked up and down the room. Then you passed out and closed the window, standing on the lawn outside, smoking a cigar and watching what occurred. Finally, after the death of Tregennis, you withdrew as you had come. Now, Dr. Sterndale, how do you justify such conduct, and what were the motives for your actions? If you prevaricate or trifle with me, I give you my assurance that the matter will pass out of my hands for ever. Our visitor's face had turned ashen grey as he listened to the words of his accuser. Now he sat for some time in thought, with his face sunk in his hands. Then, with a sudden impulsive gesture, he plucked a photograph from his breast pocket and threw it on the rustic table before us.
"That is why I have done it," said he.
It showed the bust and face of a very beautiful woman. Holmes stooped over it. "Brenda Tregennis," said he.
"Yes, Brenda Tregennis," repeated our visitor. "For years I have loved her. For years she has loved me. There is the secret of that Cornish seclusion, which people have marvelled at. It has brought me close to the one thing on earth that was dear to me. I could not marry her, for I have a wife who has left me for years, and yet whom, by the deplorable laws of England, I could not divorce. For years Brenda waited, for years I waited, and this is what we have waited for." A terrible sob shook his great frame, and he clutched his throat under his brindled beard. Then, with an effort, he mastered himself and spoke on. "The vicar knew. He was in our confidence. He would tell you that she was an angel upon earth. That was why he telegraphed to me, and I returned. What was my baggage or Africa to me when I learned that such a fate had come upon my darling?" There you have the missing clue to my action, Mr. Holmes.
Proceed, said my friend. Dr. Sterndale drew from his pocket a paper packet and laid it upon the table. On the outside was written Radix Pedis Diaboli, with a red poison label beneath it. He pushed it towards me.
I understand that you are a doctor, sir. Have you ever heard of this preparation?
Devil's foot root? No, I've never heard of it.
It is no reflection upon your professional knowledge, said he, for I believe that save for one sample in a laboratory at Buda, there is no other specimen in Europe. It has not yet found its way either into the pharmacopoeia or into the literature of toxicology. The root is shaped like a foot, half human, half goat-like, hence the fanciful name given by a botanical missionary. It is used as an ordeal poison by the medicine men in certain districts of West Africa, and is kept as a secret among them. This particular specimen I obtained under very extraordinary circumstances in the Ubangi country. He opened the paper as he spoke, and disclosed a heap of reddish-brown, snuff-like powder. "Well, sir?" asked Holmes sternly.
"I'm about to tell you, Mr. Holmes, all that actually occurred, for you already know so much that it is clearly to my interest that you should know all. I have already explained the relationship in which I stood to the Tregennis family. For the sake of the sister, I was friendly with the brothers. There was a family quarrel about money, which estranged this man Mortimer, but it was supposed to be made up, and I afterwards met him as I did the others. He was a sly, subtle, scheming man, and several things arose which gave me a suspicion of him, but I had no cause for any positive quarrel. One day, only a couple of weeks ago, he came down to my cottage, and I showed him some of my African curiosities. Among other things, I exhibited this powder, and I told him of its strange properties, how it stimulates those brain centres which control the emotion of fear, and how either madness or death is the fate of the unhappy native who is subjected to the ordeal by the priest of his tribe. I told him also how powerless European science would be to detect it. How he took it, I cannot say, for I never left the room, but there is no doubt that it was then, while I was opening cabinets and stooping to boxes, that he managed to abstract some of the devil's foot root. I remember how he plied me with questions as to the amount and the time that was needed for its effect, but I little dreamed that he could have a personal reason for asking. I thought no more of the matter until the vicar's telegram reached me at Plymouth. This villain had thought that I would be at sea before the news could reach me, and that I should be lost for years in Africa. But I returned at once. Of course, I could not listen to the details without feeling assured that my poison had been used. I came round to see you on the chance that some other explanation had suggested itself to you, but there could be none. I was convinced that Mortimer Tregennis was the murderer, that for the sake of money, and with the idea, perhaps, that if the other members of his family were all insane, he would be the sole guardian of their joint property, he had used the devil's foot powder upon them, driven two of them out of their senses, and killed his sister Brenda, the one human being whom I have ever loved, or who has ever loved me. There was his crime. What was to be his punishment? Should I appeal to the law? Where were my proofs? I knew that the facts were true, but could I help to make a jury of countrymen believe so fantastic a story? I might, or I might not, but I could not afford to fail. My soul cried out for revenge. I have said to you once before, Mr. Holmes, that I have spent much of my life outside the law, and that I have come at last to be a law to myself. So it was, even now. I determined that the fate which he had given to others should be shared by himself. Either that, or I would do justice upon him with my own hand. In all England there can be no man who sets less value upon his own life than I do at the present moment. Now I have told you all. You have yourself supplied the rest. I did, as you say, after a restless night, set off early from my cottage. I foresaw the difficulty of arousing him, so I gathered some gravel from the pile which you have mentioned, and I used it to throw up to his window. He came down and admitted me through the window of the sitting-room. I laid his offence before him. I told him that I had come both as judge and executioner. The wretch sank into a chair, paralyzed at the sight of my revolver. I lit the lamp, put the powder above it, and stood outside the window, ready to carry out my threat to shoot him should he try to leave the room. In 5 minutes he died. By God, how he died! But my heart was flint, for he endured nothing which my innocent darling had not felt before him. There is my story, Mr. Holmes. Perhaps, if you loved a woman, you would have done as much yourself. At any rate, I'm in your hands. You can take what steps you like. As I have already said, there is no man living who can fear death less than I do. Holmes sat for some little time in silence. "What were your plans?" he asked at last. "I had intended to bury myself in Central Africa. My work there is but half finished." "Go and do the other half," said Holmes. "I, at least, am not prepared to prevent you." Dr. Sterndale raised his giant figure, bowed gravely, and walked from the arbour. Holmes lit his pipe and handed me his pouch. "Some fumes which are not poisonous would be a welcome change," said he. "I think you must agree, Watson, that it is not a case in which we are called upon to interfere. Our investigation has been independent, and our action shall be also. You would not denounce the man?"
"Certainly not," I answered.
"I have never loved, Watson, but if I did, and if the woman I loved had met such an end, I might act even as our lawless lion-hunter has done. Who knows?" "Well, Watson, I will not offend your intelligence by explaining what is obvious. The gravel upon the window-sill was, of course, the starting point of my research. It was unlike anything in the vicarage garden. Only when my attention had been drawn to Dr. Sterndale and his cottage did I find its counterpart. The lamp shining in broad daylight and the remains of powder upon the shield were successive links in a fairly obvious chain. And now, my dear Watson, I think we may dismiss the matter from our mind and go back with a clear conscience to the study of those Chaldean roots which are surely to be traced in the Cornish branch of the great Celtic speech."
His last bow. It was 9 o'clock at night upon the 2nd of August, the most terrible August in the history of the world. One might have thought already that God's curse hung heavy over a degenerate world, for there was an awesome hush and a feeling of vague expectancy in the sultry and stagnant air. The sun had long set, but one blood-red gash like an open wound lay low in the distant west. Above, the stars were shining brightly, and below, the lights of the shipping glimmered in the bay. The two famous Germans stood beside the stone parapet of the garden walk, with the long, low, heavily gabled house behind them, and they looked down upon the broad sweep of the beach at the foot of the great chalk cliff on which von Bork, like some wandering eagle, had perched himself 4 years before. They stood with their heads close together, talking in low, confidential tones. From below, the two glowing ends of their cigars might have been the smouldering eyes of some malignant fiend looking down in the darkness. A remarkable man, this von Bork. A man who could hardly be matched among all the devoted agents of the Kaiser. It was his talents which had first recommended him for the English mission, the most important mission of all. But since he had taken it over, those talents had become more and more manifest to the half-dozen people in the world who were really in touch with the truth, One of these was his present companion, Baron von Herling, the chief secretary of the legation, whose huge 100-horsepower Bentz car was blocking the country lane as it waited to waft its owner back to London. So far as I can judge the trend of events, you will probably be back in Berlin within the week, the secretary was saying. When you get there, my dear von Bork, I think you will be surprised at the welcome you will receive. I happen to know what is thought in the highest quarters of your work in this country. He was a huge man, the secretary, deep, broad, and tall, with a slow, heavy fashion of speech which had been his main asset in his political career. Von Bork laughed. "They are not very hard to deceive," he remarked. "A more docile, simple folk could not be imagined." "I don't know about that," said the other thoughtfully. "They have strange limits, and one must learn to observe them. It is that surface simplicity of theirs which makes a trap for the stranger. One's first impression is that they are entirely soft. Then one comes suddenly upon something very hard, and you know that you have reached the limit and must adapt yourself to the fact. They have, for example, their insular conventions, which simply must be observed." "Meaning good form and that sort of thing?" Von Bork sighed, as one who had suffered much. "Meaning British prejudice in all its queer manifestations. As an example, I may quote one of my own worst blunders. I can afford to talk of my blunders, for you know my work well enough to be aware of my successes. It was on my first arrival. I was invited to a weekend gathering at the country house of a cabinet minister. The conversation was amazingly indiscreet." Von Bork nodded. "I've been there," said he dryly. "Exactly. Well, I naturally sent a resume of the information to Berlin. Unfortunately, our good Chancellor is a little heavy-handed in these matters, and he transmitted a remark which showed that he was aware of what had been said. This, of course, took the trail straight up to me. You've no idea the harm that it did me. There was nothing soft about our British hosts on that occasion, I can assure you. I was 2 years living it down. Now you, with this sporting pose of yours—" "No, no, don't call it a pose. A pose is an artificial thing. This is quite natural. I'm a born sportsman. I enjoy it." "Well, that makes it the more effective. You yacht against them, you hunt with them, you play polo, you match them in every game, your 4 in hand takes the prize at Olympia. I have even heard that you go the length of boxing with the younger officers. What is the result? Nobody takes you seriously. You are a good old sport, quite a decent fellow for a German. A hard-drinking nightclub, knockabout town, devil-may-care young fellow. And all the time, this quiet country house of yours is the centre of half the mischief in England, and the sporting squire, the most astute secret service man in Europe. Genius, my dear von Bork, genius." "You flatter me, Baron, but certainly I may claim that my 4 years in this country have not been unproductive. I've never shown you my little store. Would you mind stepping in for a moment?" The door of the study opened straight on to the terrace. Von Bork pushed it back, and leading the way, he clicked the switch of the electric light. He then closed the door behind the bulky form which followed him and carefully adjusted the heavy curtain over the latticed window. Only when all these precautions had been taken and tested did he turn his sunburned, aquiline face to his guest. "Some of my papers have gone," said he. "When my wife and the household left yesterday for Flushing, they took the less important with them. I must, of course, claim the protection of the embassy for the others." "Your name has already been filed as one of the personal suite. There will be no difficulties for you or your baggage.
Of course, it is just possible that we may not have to go. England may leave France to her fate. We are sure that there is no binding treaty between them.
And Belgium?
Yes, and Belgium, too.
Von Bork shook his head.
I don't see how that could be. There is a definite treaty there. She could never recover from such a humiliation.
She would at least have peace for the moment.
But her honour...
Tut, my dear sir, we live in a utilitarian age. Honour is a medieval conception. Besides, England is not ready. It is an inconceivable thing that even our special war tax of 50 million, which one would think made our purpose as clear as if we had advertised it on the front page of the Times, has not roused these people from their slumbers. Here and there one hears a question. It is my business to find an answer. Here and there also there is an irritation. It is my business to soothe it. But I can assure you that so far as the essentials go, the storage of munitions, the preparation for submarine attack, the arrangements for making high explosives, nothing is prepared. How, then, can England come in, especially when we have stirred her up such a devil's brew of Irish civil war, window-breaking furies, and God knows what, to keep her thoughts at home?
She must think of her future.
Ah, that is another matter.
I fancy that in the future we have our own very definite plans about England, and that your information will be very vital to us. It is today or tomorrow with Mr. John Bull. If he prefers today, we are perfectly ready. If it is tomorrow, we shall be more ready still. I should think they would be wiser to fight with allies than without them. But that is their own affair. This week is their week of destiny. But you were speaking of your papers.
He sat in the armchair with the light shining upon his broad, bald head, while he puffed sedately at his cigar. The large, oak-panelled, book-lined room had a curtain hung in the further corner. When this was drawn, it disclosed a large, brass-bound safe. Von Bork detached a small key from his watch-chain, and after some considerable manipulation of the lock, he swung open the heavy door.
"Look," said he, standing clear, with a wave of his hand.
The light shone vividly into the opened safe, and the secretary of the embassy gazed with an absorbed interest at the rows of stuffed pigeonholes with which it was furnished. Each pigeonhole had its label, and his eyes, as he glanced along them, read a long series of such titles as Fords, Harbour Defences, Aeroplanes, Ireland, Egypt, Portsmouth Forts, the Channel, Rosyth, and a score of others. Each compartment was bristling with papers and plans.
"Colossal," said the secretary.
Putting down his cigar, he softly clapped his fat hands.
"And all in 4 years, Baron. Not such a bad show for the hard-drinking, hard-riding country squire. But the gem of my collection is coming, and there is the setting all ready for it."
He pointed to a space over which Naval Signals was printed.
"But you have a good dossier there already."
"Out of date and waste paper. The Admiralty in some way got the alarm, and every code has been changed. It was a blow, Baron, the worst setback in my whole campaign, but thanks to my checkbook and the good Altamont, all will be well tonight."
The Baron looked at his watch and gave a guttural exclamation of disappointment.
"Well, I can really wait no longer. You can imagine that things are moving at present in Carlton Terrace, and that we have all to be at our posts. I had hoped to be able to bring news of your great coup,
Did Altamont name no hour?
Von Bork pushed over a telegram.
We'll come without fail tonight and bring new sparking plugs. Altamont.
Sparking plugs, eh?
You see, he poses as a motor expert, and I keep a full garage. In our code, everything likely to come up is named after some spare part. If he talks of a radiator, it is a battleship, of an oil pump, a cruiser, and so on. Sparking plugs are naval signals.
From Portsmouth at midday, said the secretary, examining the superscription.
By the way, what do you give him?
£500 for this particular job. Of course, he has a salary as well.
The greedy rogue! They are useful, these traitors, but I grudge them their blood money.
I grudge Altamont nothing. He is a wonderful worker. If I pay him well, at least he delivers the goods, to use his own phrase. Besides, he is not a traitor. I assure you that our most pan-Germanic Junker is a sucking dove in his feelings towards England, as compared with a real bitter Irish-American.
Oh, an Irish-American!
If you heard him talk, you would not doubt it. Sometimes, I assure you, I can hardly understand him. He seems to have declared war on the King's English, as well as on the English King.
Must you really go? He may be here any moment.
No, I'm sorry, but I have already overstayed my time. We shall expect you early tomorrow, and when you get that signal book through the little door on the Duke of York's steps, you can put a triumphant finis to your record in England.
What? Tokai?
He indicated a heavily sealed, dust-covered bottle which stood with two high glasses upon a salver.
May I offer you a glass before your journey?
No, thanks, but it looks like revelry.
Altamont has a nice taste in wines, and he took a fancy to my Tokai. He is a touchy fellow and needs humouring in small things. I have to study him, I assure you.
They had strolled out onto the terrace again, and along it to the further end, where at a touch from the Baron's chauffeur, the great car shivered and chuckled.
"Those are the lights of Harwich, I suppose," said the secretary, pulling on his dust-coat. "How still and peaceful it all seems. There may be other lights within the week, and the English coast a less tranquil place. The heavens, too, may not be quite so peaceful if all that the good Zeppelin promises us comes true. By the way, who is that?"
Only one window showed a light behind them. In it there stood a lamp, and beside it, seated at a table, was a dear old ruddy-faced woman in a country cap. She was bending over her knitting and stopping occasionally to stroke a large black cat upon a stool beside her.
"That is Marta, the only servant I have left."
The secretary chuckled. "She might almost personify Britannia," said he, "with her complete self-absorption and general air of comfortable somnolence. Well, au revoir, von Bork."
With a final wave of his hand, he sprang into the car, and a moment later the two golden cones from the headlights shot forward through the darkness. The secretary lay back in the cushions of the luxurious limousine, with his thoughts so full of the impending European tragedy that he hardly observed that as his car swung round the village street, it nearly passed over a little ford coming in the opposite direction. Von Bork walked slowly back to the study when the last gleams of the motor lamps had faded into the distance. As he passed, he observed that his old housekeeper had put out her lamp and retired. It was a new experience to him, the silence and darkness of his widespread house, for his family and household had been a large one. It was a relief, to him, however, to think that they were all in safety. But for that one old woman who had lingered in the kitchen, he had the whole place to himself. There was a good deal of tidying up to do inside his study, and he set himself to do it until his keen, handsome face was flushed with the heat of the burning papers. A leather valise stood beside his table, and into this he began to pack very neatly and systematically the precious contents of his safe. He had hardly got started with the work, however, when his quick ears caught the sound of a distant car. Instantly he gave an exclamation of satisfaction, strapped up the valise, shut the safe, locked it, and hurried out onto the terrace. He was just in time to see the lights of a small car come to a halt at the gate. A passenger sprang out of it and advanced swiftly towards him, while the chauffeur, a heavily built, elderly man with a grey moustache, settled down like one who resigns himself to a long vigil. "Well?" asked von Bork eagerly, running forward to meet his visitor. For answer, the man waved a small brown paper parcel triumphantly above his head.
"You can give me the glad hand tonight, mister," he cried. "I'm bringing home the bacon at last."
"The signals?"
"Same as I said in my cable. Every last one of them, semaphore, lamp code, Marconi, a copy, mind you, not the original. That was too dangerous. But it's the real goods, and you can lay to that."
He slapped the German upon the shoulder with a rough familiarity from which the other winced.
"Come in," he said. "I'm all alone in the house. I was only waiting for this. Of course, a copy is better than the original. If an original were missing, they would change the whole thing. You think it's all safe about the copy?"
The Irish-American had entered the study and stretched his long limbs from the armchair. He was a tall, gaunt man of 60, with clear-cut features and a small goatee beard, which gave him a general resemblance to the caricatures of Uncle Sam. A half-smoked, sodden cigar hung from the corner of his mouth, and as he sat down he struck a match and relit it.
"Making ready for a move," he remarked as he looked round him. "Say, mister," he added, as his eyes fell upon the safe from which the curtain was now removed, "you don't tell me you keep your papers in that."
"Why not?"
"Gosh! In a wide-open contraption like that? And they reckon you to be some spy? Why, a Yankee crook would be into that with a can opener. If I'd known that any letter of mine was going to lie loose in a thing like that, I'd have been a mug to write to you at all."
"It would puzzle any crook to force that safe," von Bork answered.
"You won't cut that metal with any tool.
But the lock?"
"No, it's a double combination lock. You know what that is?"
"Search me," said the American.
"Well, you need a word as well as a set of figures before you can get the lock to work." He rose and showed a double radiating disc round the keyhole. "This outer one is for the letters, the inner one for the figures."
"Well, well, that's fine. So it's not quite as simple as you thought. It was 4 years ago that I had it made, and what do you think I chose for the word and figures?"
"It's beyond me."
"Well, I chose August for the word, and 1914 for the figures, and here we are."
The American's face showed his surprise and admiration.
"My, but that was smart! You had it down to a fine thing."
"Yes, a few of us even then could have guessed the date. Here it is, and I'm shutting down tomorrow morning.
Well, I guess you'll have to fix me up also. I'm not staying in this gull-darn country all on my lonesome.
In a week or less, from what I see, John Bull will be on his hind legs and fair ramping. I'd rather watch him from over the water."
"But you're an American citizen."
Well, so was Jack James, an American citizen, but he's doing time in Portland all the same. It cuts no ice with a British copper to tell him you're an American citizen.
It's British law and order over here, says he.
By the way, mister, talking of Jack James, it seems to me you don't do much to cover your man.
What do you mean?
Von Bork asked sharply.
Well, you're their employer, ain't you? It's up to you to see that they don't fall down.
But they do fall down. And when did you ever pick them up? There's James.
It was James's own fault. You know that yourself. He was too self-willed for the job.
James was a bonehead, I give you that. Then there was Hollis. The man was mad.
Well, he went a bit woozy towards the end. It's enough to make a man bughouse when he has to play a part from morning to night with 100 guys all ready to set the coppers wise to him. But now there is Steiner.
Von Bork started violently, and his ruddy face turned a shade paler.
What about Steiner?
Well, they've got him, that's all. They raided his store last night, and he and his papers are all in Portsmouth jail.
You'll go off, and he, poor devil, will have to stand the racket, and lucky if he gets off with his life. That's why I want to get over the water as soon as you do.
Von Bork was a strong, self-contained man, but it was easy to see that the news had shaken him.
How could they have got on to Steiner? He muttered.
That's the worst blow yet.
Well, you nearly had a worse one, for I believe they're not far off me.
You don't mean that.
Sure thing. My landlady down Fratton way had some inquiries, and when I heard of it, I guessed it was time for me to hustle.
But what I want to know, mister, is how the coppers know these things. Steiner is the fifth man you've lost since I signed on with you, and I know the name of the sixth if I don't get a move on. How do you explain it? And ain't you ashamed to see your men go down like this?
Von Bork flushed crimson.
How dare you speak in such a way?
If I didn't dare things, mister, I wouldn't be in your service, but I'll tell you straight what is in my mind. I've heard that with you German politicians, when an agent has done his work, you are not sorry to see him put away.
Von Bork sprang to his feet.
Do you dare to suggest that I have given away my own agents?
I don't stand for that, mister, but there's a stool pigeon or a cross somewhere, and it's up to you to find out where it is. Anyhow, I'm taking no more chances. It's me for Little Holland, and the sooner the better.
Von Bork had mastered his anger.
We have been allies too long to quarrel now at the very hour of victory, he said. You've done splendid work and taken risks, and I can't forget it. By all means, go to Holland, and you can get a boat from Rotterdam to New York. No other line will be safe a week from now. I'll take that book and pack it with the rest.
The American held the small parcel in his hand, but made no motion to give it up.
What about the dough? He asked.
The what?
The boodle, the reward, the £500. The gunner turned damn nasty at the last, and I had to square him with an extra $100, or it would have been Nitsky for you and me. Nothing doing, says he, and he meant it too. But the last 100 did it. It cost me £200 from first to last, so it isn't likely I'd give it up without getting my wad.
Von Bork smiled with some bitterness.
You don't seem to have a very high opinion of my honour, said he. You want the money before you give up the book?
Well, mister, it's a business proposition.
All right, have your way.
He sat down at the table and scribbled a check, which he tore from the book, but he refrained from handing it to his companion.
After all, since we are to be on such terms, Mr. Altamont, said he, I don't see why I should trust you any more than you trust me. Do you understand? He added, looking back over his shoulder at the American. There's the check upon the table.
I claim the right to examine that parcel before you pick the money up."
The American passed it over without a word. Von Bork undid a winding of string and two wrappers of paper. Then he sat gazing for a moment in silent amazement at a small blue book which lay before him. Across the cover was printed in golden letters, "Practical Handbook of Bee Culture." Only for one instant did the master spy glare at this strangely irrelevant inscription. The next, he was gripped at the back of his neck by a grasp of iron, and a chloroformed sponge was held in front of his writhing face. "Another glass, Watson," said Mr. Sherlock Holmes, as he extended the bottle of Imperial Tokai. The thick-set chauffeur, who had seated himself by the table, pushed forward his glass with some eagerness.
"It is a good wine, Holmes."
"A remarkable wine, Watson. Our friend upon the sofa has assured me that it is from Franz Josef's special cellar at the Schönbrunn Palace. Might I trouble you to open the window, for chloroform vapour does not help the palate." The safe was ajar, and Holmes, standing in front of it, was removing dossier after dossier, swiftly examining each and then packing it neatly in von Bork's valise. The German lay upon the sofa, sleeping stertorously with a strap round his upper arms and another round his legs.
"We need not hurry ourselves, Watson. We are safe from interruption. Would you mind touching the bell? There is no one in the house except old Martha, who has played her part to admiration. I got her the situation here when I first took the matter up. Ah, Martha, you will be glad to hear that all is well."
The pleasant old lady had appeared in the doorway. She curtsied with a smile to Mr. Holmes, but glanced with some apprehension at the figure upon the sofa. "It's all right, Martha. He has not been hurt at all."
"I am glad of that, Mr. Holmes. According to his lights, he has been a kind master. He wanted me to go with his wife to Germany yesterday, but that would hardly have suited your plans, would it, sir?"
"No, indeed, Martha. So long as you were here, I was easy in my mind. We waited some time for your signal tonight."
"It was the secretary, sir."
"I know. His car passed ours."
"I thought he would never go. I knew that it would not suit your plan, sir, to find him here."
"No, indeed. Well, it only meant that we waited half an hour or so until I saw your lamp go out and knew that the coast was clear. You can report to me tomorrow in London, Martha, at Claridge's Hotel."
"Very good, sir."
"I suppose you have everything ready to leave?"
"Yes, sir. He posted 7 letters today. I have the addresses, as usual."
"Very good, Martha. I will look into them tomorrow. Good night. These papers," he continued as the old lady vanished, "are not of very great importance, for, of course, the information which they represent has been sent off long ago to the German government. These are the originals which could not safely be got out of the country."
"Then they are of no use."
"I should not go so far as to say that, Watson. They will at least show our people what is known and what is not. I may say that a good many of these papers have come through me, and I need not add, are thoroughly untrustworthy. It would brighten my declining years to see a German cruiser navigating the Solent according to the minefield plans which I have furnished. But you, Watson," he stopped his work and took his old friend by the shoulders, "I've hardly seen you in the light yet. How have the years used you? You look the same blithe boy as ever."
"I feel 20 years younger, Holmes. I've seldom felt so happy as when I got your wire asking me to meet you at Harwich with the car. But you, Holmes, you have changed very little, save for that horrible goatee."
"These are the sacrifices one makes for one's country, Watson," said Holmes, pulling at his little tuft. "Tomorrow it will be but a dreadful memory. With my hair cut and a few other superficial changes, I shall no doubt reappear at Claridge's tomorrow
as I was before this American stunt. I beg your pardon, Watson. My well of English seems to be permanently defiled before this American job came my way. But you have retired, Holmes. We heard of you as living the life of a hermit among your bees and your books in a small farm upon the South Downs. Exactly, Watson. Here is the fruit of my leisured ease, the magnum opus of my latter years. He picked up the volume from the table and read out the whole title. Practical Handbook of Bee Culture, with some observations upon the segregation of the queen. Alone I did it. Behold the fruit of pensive nights and laborious days, when I watched the little working gangs as once I watched the criminal world of London. But how did you get to work again? Ah, I have often marvelled at it myself. The foreign minister alone I could have withstood, but when the premier also deigned to visit my humble roof. The fact is, Watson, that this gentleman upon the sofa was a bit too good for our people. He was in a class by himself. Things were going wrong, and no one could understand why they were going wrong. Agents were suspected or even caught, but there was evidence of some strong and secret central force. It was absolutely necessary to expose it. Strong pressure was brought upon me to look into the matter. It has cost me 2 years, Watson, but they have not been devoid of excitement. When I say that I started my pilgrimage at Chicago, graduated in an Irish secret society at Buffalo, gave serious trouble to the constabulary at Skibbereen, and so eventually caught the eye of a subordinate agent of von Bork, who recommended me as a likely man, you will realize that the matter was complex. Since then I have been honored by his confidence, which has not prevented most of his plans going subtly wrong, and 5 of his best agents being in prison. I watched them, Watson, and I picked them as they ripened. Well, sir, I hope that you are none the worse. The last remark was addressed to von Bork himself, who, after much gasping and blinking, had lain quietly listening to Holmes's statement. He broke out now into a furious stream of German invective, his face convulsed with passion. Holmes continued his swift investigation of documents, while his prisoner cursed and swore. Though unmusical, German is the most expressive of all languages, he observed, when von Bork had stopped from pure exhaustion. Hello? Hello? He added, as he looked hard at the corner of a tracing before putting it in the box. This should put another bird in the cage. I had no idea that the paymaster was such a rascal, though I have long had an eye upon him. Mr. von Bork, you have a great deal to answer for. The prisoner had raised himself with some difficulty upon the sofa, and was staring with a strange mixture of amazement and hatred at his captor. "I shall get level with you, Altamont," he said, speaking with slow deliberation. "If it takes me all my life, I shall get level with you." "The old sweet song," said Holmes. "How often have I heard it in days gone by? It was a favourite ditty of the late lamented Professor Moriarty. Colonel Sebastian Moran has also been known to warble it, and yet I live and keep bees upon the South Downs." "Curse you, you double traitor!" cried the German, straining against his bonds and glaring murder from his furious eyes. "No, no, it is not so bad as that," said Holmes, smiling. "As my speech surely shows you, Mr. Altamont of Chicago had no existence in fact. I used him, and he is gone." "Then who are you?" "It is really immaterial who I am, but since the matter seems to interest you, Mr. von Bork, I may say that this is not my first acquaintance with the members of your family. I have done a good deal of business in Germany in the past, and my name is probably familiar to you." "I would wish to know it,"
said the Prussian grimly. It was I who brought about the separation between Irene Adler and the late King of Bohemia, when your cousin Heinrich was the imperial envoy. It was I also who saved from murder by the nihilist Kloppmann Count von and zu Grafenstein, who was your mother's elder brother. It was I— Von Bork sat up in amazement.
"There is only one man!" he cried.
"Exactly," said Holmes. Von Bork groaned and sank back on the sofa.
"And most of that information came through you!" he cried. "What is it worth? What have I done? It is my ruin forever!"
"It is certainly a little untrustworthy," said Holmes. "It will require some checking, and you have little time to check it. Your admiral may find the new guns rather larger than he expects, and the cruisers perhaps a trifle faster."
Von Bork clutched at his own throat in despair.
"There are a good many other points of detail which will, no doubt, come to light in good time. But you have one quality which is very rare in a German, Mr. von Bork. You are a sportsman, and you will bear me no ill will when you realize that you, who have outwitted so many other people, have at last been outwitted yourself. After all, you have done your best for your country, and I have done my best for mine. What could be more natural? Besides," he added, not unkindly, as he laid his hand upon the shoulder of the prostrate man, "it is better than to fall before some more ignoble foe. These papers are now ready. Watson, if you will help me with our prisoner, I think that we may get started for London at once."
It was no easy task to move von Bork, for he was a strong and a desperate man. Finally, holding either arm, the two friends walked him very slowly down the garden walk, which he had trod with such proud confidence when he received the congratulations of the famous diplomatist only a few hours before. After a short, final struggle, he was hoisted, still bound hand and foot, into the spare seat of the little car. His precious valise was wedged in beside him.
"I trust that you are as comfortable as circumstances permit," said Holmes, when the final arrangements were made. "Should I be guilty of a liberty if I lit a cigar and placed it between your lips?"
But all amenities were wasted upon the angry German.
"I suppose you realize, Mr. Sherlock Holmes," said he, "that if your government bears you out in this treatment, it becomes an act of war."
"What about your government and all this treatment?" said Holmes, tapping the valise.
"You are a private individual. You have no warrant for my arrest. The whole proceeding is absolutely illegal and outrageous."
"Absolutely," said Holmes.
"Kidnapping a German subject!"
"And stealing his private papers."
"Well, you realize your position, you and your accomplice here. If I were to shout for help as we pass through the village—"
"My dear sir, if you did anything so foolish, you would probably enlarge the two limited titles of our village inns by giving us the Dangling Prussian as a signpost. The Englishman is a patient creature, but at present his temper is a little inflamed, and it would be as well not to try him too far. No, Mr. von Bork, you will go with us in a quiet, sensible fashion to Scotland Yard, whence you can send for your friend Baron von Herling, and see if even now you may not fill that place which he has reserved for you in the ambassadorial suite. As to you, Watson, you are joining us with your old service, as I understand, so London won't be out of your way. Stand with me here upon the terrace, for it may be the last quiet talk that we shall ever have." The two friends chatted in intimate converse for a few minutes, recalling once again the days of the past, while their prisoner vainly wriggled to undo the bonds that held him. As they turned to the car, Holmes pointed back to the moonlit sea and shook a thoughtful head.
"There's an east wind coming, Watson."
"I think not, Holmes. It is very warm."
good old Watson. You are the one fixed point in a changing age. There's an east wind coming all the same. Such a wind as never blew on England yet. It will be cold and bitter, Watson, and a good many of us may wither before its blast. But it's God's own wind none the less, and a cleaner, better, stronger land will lie in the sunshine when the storm has cleared. Start her up, Watson, for it's time that we were on our way. I have a cheque for £500, which should be cashed early, for the drawer is quite capable of stopping it, if he can.
The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes. Foreword by Stephen Fry. And so we come to the final collection of Sherlock Holmes adventures to be given the world by their creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. When, in 1927, he placed the full stop at the end of the concluding sentence of the last mystery, The Adventure of Shoscombe Old Place, Conan Doyle was finishing his 56th short story in the Sherlock Holmes canon, to which he had also contributed 4 full-length novels, and so ended one of the most popular series involving perhaps the most memorable, instantly recognizable fictional characters ever presented to a devotedly enthusiastic reading public. To take the collection first, there are 12 tales here in all, 2 of them standing out by having as their narrator not the usual faithful chronicler Dr. Watson, but Sherlock Holmes himself. The first in this collection, The Adventure of the Mazarin Stone, like the title story of His Last Bow, is not told by either, but is written in a dispassionate third person. It also takes place in just one room. Both these peculiarities betray its origin as a stage play, which was called The Crown Diamond. Otherwise, in the casebook, there is presented the usual collection of varied problems for the great detective to solve. Some of you might notice variations on favourite themes. What is the tale The Three Garidebs, but a kind of reworking of the Red-Headed League? And surely the retired colour man reminds us of an even more malignant Norwood builder. We have met the owners of great racehorses before, and mysterious lodgers with a dark history. The apparently supernatural phenomena that bear a more rational causation, these we have encountered before also. Merciless blackmailers, clients of such importance that their names are withheld, strange discoloured faces at the window, and incomprehensible phrases gasped out by dying men. These are all familiar tropes. But we do not feel cheated or sold short to hear these new tunes played on old instruments. A great part of the pleasure of Holmes and Watson comes from the comfort of familiarity. To readers then, as to readers now, living in a world of breakneck speed, seemingly bent on self-destruction, the reliable Victorian certainty of Holmes's pipe, deerstalker, lens and dressing gown was and is just what is wanted. It is strange, almost alarming, to recall that this collection came out in the jazz age, the age of cigarette-smoking flappers, cocktails, art deco and sports cars. Wisely, Conan Doyle keeps Holmes and Watson where they belong, in the gaslit London of the previous century. The great author was approaching the end of his 60s at this point. He was a widely respected figure, quite as celebrated as grand contemporaries like Kipling and Shaw, though as a popular writer, he was, of course, never in the running for the Nobel Prize they each secured. He was a Knight of the Realm, though, doubly so, in fact, dubbed a Knight Bachelor in 1902, and created a Knight of Grace of the Most Venerable Order of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem the following year. In that concluding sentence of this collection, he closed the book on Holmes, and perhaps on his own writing life, with a farewell to a career which has now outlived its shadows and promises to end in an honoured old age. Doyle was, in fact, only to live another 3 years before succumbing to a heart attack at the age of 71, while Holmes turned out to be immortal. There is a statue to Doyle in his native Edinburgh,
as well as another in Crowborough, East Sussex, where he and his wife Jean lived out their later years. But Holmes seemed only just to be getting going. The Sherlock industry shows no sign of slowing to this day. On the contrary, it seems each year to be gathering fresh pace and new popularity. I don't suppose the number of Holmes' artifacts, statues, portraits, portrayals, adaptations, merchandise, and spin-offs around the world could be counted. Just a silhouette of that hawk-like profile with deerstalker and sinuous pipe is all that is ever needed to say Sherlock Holmes. How many other fictional characters from books could be so quickly recreated with just a few swiftly drawn lines or suggested with such clarity by so few props and appurtenances? Perhaps only Harry Potter with his lightning scar, broomstick and round spectacles might also be so instantly identified by almost anyone on the planet. When Doyle died, the actor William Gillette was already a household name for personating Holmes on the stage. The young Noel Coward got his first professional role as Billy the Pageboy. The Samuelson Company, still in the movie business today, into the third generation, had produced the first ever feature film adaptation of Holmes, a version of A Study in Scarlet, in 1914. It even used locations, the Cheddar Gorge in Somerset, standing in for the Rockies, and Southport Sands near Liverpool, making do as the plains of Utah. Shorter versions had been made of Holmes' stories, but this was the first feature-length presentation. It is worth quoting a contemporary review in the Kinematograph Monthly Film Review of November 1914. "It is a truism to say that Sherlock Holmes is always welcome on the screen. The few film adaptations to be seen of Conan Doyle's great series are, we believe, immensely popular with all classes of people, and there are certainly a great number yet of those famous detective adventures which might be turned into pictures with advantage. Personally, we do not think that either the legitimate drama or the picture drama can recapture for us the first fine, careless rapture we felt when we came upon these stories in their original version. But we are firmly of the opinion that in visualizing what is at its finest a purely literary pleasure, viz. A high-class detective yarn, the screen has hitherto proved itself a superior medium to the stage." Scores and scores of films were to follow in Doyle's lifetime alone. The entire canon and more was recorded as dramas for radio by the BBC in the 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century. Holmes has been bent and twisted into every genre imaginable and unimaginable: graphic novels, manga, science fiction, time travel, erotica, literary novels, animation, horror stories, comic books, gaming, and more. Junior Sherlocks, animal Sherlocks, spoofs called Sheer Luck and Schlock. You think it up, and you'll find it's been done before. There is no indignity that has not been heaped upon the sage and super sleuth of Baker Street. Yet he survives. He more than survives. He rises up higher and higher with each passing decade, untarnished and unequalled, because I suppose we need him more and more. A figure of authority that is benign, rational, soothing, omniscient, capable, and insightful, in a world and in daily lives so patently devoid of almost all those marvellous qualities, how welcome that is, and how grateful we are for its presence in our lives. So grateful that we won't really accept that Sherlock Holmes could ever be classed as make-believe. Between fact and fiction is a space where legend dwells. It is where Holmes and Watson will always live. I hope you have enjoyed these original stories from the pen of the great originator, Arthur Conan Doyle, and that your time in Sherlock Holmes's company and the company of the dogged and loyal Dr. Watson and all the other characters in their world of mists and mystery has given you pleasure. For me to be able to read you these stories has certainly been an absolute and unalloyed joy and privilege. So, here we are, for the last time, looking in on the first floor rooms of 221B Baker Street, London. Dr. Watson is looking in on his old friend even now. Let us see what they might be up to.
The Adventure of the Mazarin Stone. It was pleasant to Dr. Watson to find himself once more in the untidy room of the first floor in Baker Street, which had been the starting point of so many remarkable adventures. He looked round him at the scientific charts upon the wall, the acid-charred bench of chemicals, the violin case leaning in the corner, the coal scuttle, which contained of old the pipes and tobacco. Finally, his eyes came round to the fresh and smiling face of Billy, the young but very wise and tactful page, who had helped a little to fill up the gap of loneliness and isolation which surrounded the saturnine figure of the great detective.
"It all seems very unchanged, Billy. You don't change either. I hope the same can be said of him."
Billy glanced with some solicitude at the closed door of the bedroom. "I think he's in bed and asleep," he said. It was 7 in the evening of a lovely summer's day, but Dr. Watson was sufficiently familiar with the irregularity of his old friend's hours to feel no surprise at the idea.
"That means a case, I suppose."
"Yes, sir. He's very hard at it just now. I'm frightened for his health. He gets paler and thinner, and he eats nothing. When will you be pleased to dine, Mr. Holmes?" Mrs. Hudson asked.
7:30 the day after tomorrow," said he.
"You know his way when he's keen on a case."
"Yes, Billy, I know."
"He's following someone. Yesterday he was out as a workman, looking for a job. Today he was an old woman. Fairly took me in, he did, and I ought to know his ways by now."
Billy pointed with a grin to a very baggy parasol which leaned against the sofa.
"That's part of the old woman's outfit," he said.
"But what is it all about, Billy?"
Billy sank his voice as one who discusses great secrets of state.
"I don't mind telling you, sir, but it should go no farther. It's this case of the Crown Diamond."
"What, the £100,000 burglary?"
"Yes, sir. They must get it back, sir. Why, we had the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary both sitting on that very sofa. Mr. Holmes was very nice to them. He soon put them at their ease and promised he would do all he could.
Then there is Lord Cantlemere."
"Ah, yes, sir. You know what that means. He's a stiff 'un, sir, if I may say so. I can get along with the Prime Minister, and I've nothing against the Home Secretary, who seemed a civil, obliging sort of man. But I can't stand his lordship. Neither can Mr. Holmes, sir. You see, he don't believe in Mr. Holmes, and he was against employing him. He'd rather he failed."
"And Mr. Holmes knows it?"
"Mr. Holmes always knows whatever there is to know."
"Well, we'll hope he won't fail, and that Lord Cantlemere will be confounded. But I say, Billy, what is that curtain for across the window?"
"Mr. Holmes had it put up there 3 days ago. We've got something funny behind it."
Billy advanced and drew away the drapery which screened the alcove of the bow window. Dr. Watson could not restrain a cry of amazement. There was a facsimile of his old friend, dressing gown and all, the face turned 3/4 towards the window and downward, as though reading an invisible book, while the body was sunk deep in an armchair. Billy detached the head and held it in the air.
"We put it at different angles, so that it may seem more lifelike. I wouldn't dare touch it if the blind were not down, but when it's up, you can see this from across the way."
"We used something of the sort once before."
"Before my time," said Billy.
He drew the window curtains apart and looked out into the street.
"There are folk who watch us from over yonder. I can see a fellow now at the window. Have a look for yourself."
Watson had taken a step forward when the bedroom door opened and the long, thin form of Holmes emerged, his face pale and drawn, but his step and bearing as active as ever. With a single spring he was at the window and had drawn the blind once more.
"That will do, Billy," said he. "You were in danger of your life then, my boy, and I can't do without you just yet." "Well, Watson,
"It's good to see you in your old quarters once again. You come at a critical moment."
"So I gather."
"You can go, Billy."
"That boy is a problem, Watson. How far am I justified in allowing him to be in danger?"
"Danger of what, Holmes?"
"Of sudden death. I'm expecting something this evening."
"Expecting what?"
"To be murdered, Watson."
"No, no, you're joking, Holmes."
"Even my limited sense of humour could evolve a better joke than that. But we may be comfortable in the meantime, may we not? Is alcohol permitted? The gasogene and cigars are in the old place. Let me see you once more in the customary armchair. You have not, I hope, learned to despise my pipe and my lamentable tobacco. It has to take the place of food these days."
"But why not eat?"
"Because the faculties become refined when you starve them."
"Why, surely, as a doctor, my dear Watson, you must admit that what your digestion gains in the way of blood supply is so much lost to the brain. I am a brain, Watson. The rest of me is a mere appendix. Therefore it is the brain I must consider."
"But this danger, Holmes."
"Ah, yes. In case it should come off, it would perhaps be as well that you should burden your memory with the name and address of the murderer. You can give it to Scotland Yard with my love and a parting blessing. Silvius is the name. Count Negretto Silvius. Write it down, man, write it down. 136 Moorside Gardens, N.W. Got it?"
Watson's honest face was twitching with anxiety. He knew only too well the immense risks taken by Holmes, and was well aware that what he said was more likely to be understatement than exaggeration. Watson was always the man of action, and he rose to the occasion.
"Count me in, Holmes. I have nothing to do for a day or two."
"Your morals don't improve, Watson. You have added fibbing to your other vices. You bear every sign of the busy medical man, with calls on him every hour."
"Not such important ones. But can't you have this fellow arrested?"
"Yes, Watson, I could. That's what worries him so."
"But why don't you?"
"Because I don't know where the diamond is."
"Ah, Billy told me, the missing crown jewel."
"Yes, the great yellow Mazarin stone. I've cast my net, and I have my fish, but I have not got the stone. What is the use of taking them? We can make the world a better place by laying them by the heels, but that is not what I am out for. It's the stone I want."
"And is this Count Silvius one of your fish?"
"Yes, and he's a shark. He bites. The other is Sam Merton, the boxer. Not a bad fellow, Sam, but the Count has used him. Sam's not a shark. He is a great big silly bull-headed gudgeon. But he's flopping about in my net all the same."
"Where is this Count Silvius?"
"I've been at his very elbow all the morning. You've seen me as an old lady, Watson. I was never more convincing. He actually picked up my parasol for me once.
'By your leave, madame,' said he, half Italian, you know, and with the southern graces of manner when in the mood, but a devil incarnate in the other mood.
Life is full of whimsical happenings, Watson."
"It might have been tragedy."
"Well, perhaps it might. I followed him to old Straubensee's workshop in the Minories. Straubensee made the air gun. Very pretty bit of work, as I understand, and I rather fancy it is in the opposite window at the present moment. Have you seen the dummy? Of course, Billy showed it to you. Well, it may get a bullet through its beautiful head at any moment. Ah, Billy, what is it?" The boy had reappeared in the room with a card upon a tray. Holmes glanced at it with raised eyebrows and an amused smile.
"The man himself! I had hardly expected this. Grasp the nettle, Watson! A man of nerve. Possibly you have heard of his reputation as a shooter of big game. It would indeed be a triumphant ending to his excellent sporting record if he added me to his bag. This is a proof that he feels my toe very close behind his heel."
"Send for the police."
"I probably shall, but not just yet.
Would you glance carefully out of the window, Watson, and see if anyone is hanging about in the street?
Watson looked warily round the edge of the curtain.
Yes, there is one rough fellow near the door.
That will be Sam Merton, the faithful but rather fatuous Sam. Where is this gentleman, Billy?
In the waiting room, sir.
Show him up when I ring.
Yes, sir.
If I am not in the room, show him in all the same.
Yes, sir.
Watson waited until the door was closed, and then he turned earnestly to his companion.
Look here, Holmes, this is simply impossible. This is a desperate man who sticks at nothing. He may have come to murder you.
I should not be surprised.
I insist upon staying with you.
You would be horribly in the way.
In his way?
No, my dear fellow, in my way.
Well, I can't possibly leave you.
Yes, you can, Watson, and you will, for you have never failed to play the game. I am sure you will play it to the end. This man has come for his own purpose, but he may stay for mine. Holmes took out his notebook and scribbled a few lines. Take a cab to Scotland Yard and give this to Ugel of the CID. Come back with the police. The fellow's arrest will follow.
I'll do that with joy.
Before you return, I may have just time enough to find out where the stone is. He touched the bell. I think we will go out through the bedroom. This second exit is exceedingly useful. I rather want to see my shark without his seeing me, and I have, as you will remember, my own way of doing it. It was, therefore, an empty room into which Billy, a minute later, ushered Count Silvius. The famous game-shot, sportsman and man about town was a big, swarthy fellow, with a formidable dark moustache shading a cruel, thin-lipped mouth and surmounted by a long, curved nose like the beak of an eagle. He was well-dressed, but his brilliant necktie, shining pin, and glittering rings were flamboyant in their effect. As the door closed behind him, he looked round him with fierce, startled eyes, like one who suspects a trap at every turn. Then he gave a violent start as he saw the impassive head and the collar of the dressing gown which projected above the armchair in the window. At first, his expression was one of pure amazement. Then the light of a horrible hope gleamed in his dark, murderous eyes. He took one more glance round to see that there were no witnesses, and then, on tiptoe, his thick stick half raised, he approached the silent figure. He was crouching for his final spring and blow when a cool, sardonic voice greeted him from the open bedroom door.
"Don't break it, Count, don't break it."
The assassin staggered back, amazement in his convulsed face. For an instant he half raised his loaded cane once more, as if he would turn his violence from the effigy to the original. But there was something in that steady grey eye and mocking smile which caused his hand to sink to his side.
"It's a pretty little thing," said Holmes, advancing towards the image. "Tavernier, the French modeller, made it. He is as good at waxworks as your friend Straubensee is at air guns."
"Air guns, sir? What do you mean?"
"Put your hat and stick on the side table. Thank you. Pray, take a seat. Would you care to put your revolver out also?" "Oh, very good, if you prefer to sit upon it." "Your visit is really most opportune, for I wanted badly to have a few minutes' chat with you."
The Count scowled with heavy, threatening eyebrows.
"I, too, wish to have some words with you, Holmes. That is why I am here. I won't deny that I intended to assault you just now."
Holmes swung his leg on the edge of the table.
"I rather gathered that you had some idea of the sort in your head," said he. "But why these personal attentions?"
"Because you have gone out of your way to annoy me. Because you have put your creatures upon my track."
"My creatures? I assure you, no."
"Nonsense.
I've had them followed. Two can play at that game, Holmes.
It is a small point, Count Silvius, but perhaps you would kindly give me my prefix when you address me. You can understand that with my routine of work I should find myself on familiar terms with half the rogues' gallery, and you will agree that exceptions are invidious.
Well, Mr. Holmes, then.
Excellent. But I assure you, you are mistaken about my alleged agents.
Count Silvius laughed contemptuously.
Other people can observe as well as you. Yesterday there was an old sporting man. Today it was an elderly woman. They held me in view all day.
Really, sir, you compliment me. Old Baron Dowson said the night before he was hanged that in my case what the law had gained, the stage had lost, and now you give my little impersonations your kindly praise.
It was you? You yourself?
Holmes shrugged his shoulders. You can see in the corner the parasol which you so politely handed to me in the Minories before you began to suspect.
If I had known, you might never
have seen this humble home again. I was well aware of it. We all have neglected opportunities to deplore. As it happens, you did not know. So, here we are.
The Count's knotted brows gathered more heavily over his menacing eyes.
What you say only makes the matter worse.
It was not your agents, but your play-acting, busybody self. You admit that you have dogged me. Why?
Come now, Count. You used to shoot lions in Algeria.
Well,
but why?
Why, the sport, the excitement, the danger.
And, no doubt, to free the country from a pest.
Exactly.
My reasons in a nutshell.
The Count sprang to his feet, and his hand involuntarily moved back to his hip pocket.
Sit down, sir, sit down. There was another, more practical reason. I want that yellow diamond.
Count Silvius lay back in his chair with an evil smile.
Upon my word, said he.
You knew that I was after you for that. The real reason why you are here tonight is to find out how much I know about the matter and how far my removal is absolutely essential.
Well, I should say that from your point of view it is absolutely essential, for I know all about it, save only one thing, which you are about to tell me.
Oh, indeed! And pray, what is this missing fact?
Where the Crown Diamond now is.
The Count looked sharply at his companion.
Oh, you want to know that, do you? How the devil should I be able to tell you where it is?
You can. And you will.
Indeed.
You can't bluff me, Count Silvius. Holmes's eyes, as he gazed at him, contracted and lightened until they were like two menacing points of steel. You are absolute plate glass. I see to the very back of your mind.
Then, of course, you see where the diamond is.
Holmes clapped his hands with amusement and then pointed a derisive finger.
Then you do know. You have admitted it.
I admit nothing.
Now, Count, if you will be reasonable, we can do business. If not, you will get hurt.
Count Silvius threw up his eyes to the ceiling.
And you talk about bluff, said he.
Holmes looked at him thoughtfully, like a master chess player who meditates his crowning move. Then he threw open the table drawer and drew out a squat notebook.
Do you know what I keep in this book?
No, sir, I do not.
You.
Me?
Yes, sir, you. You are all here, every action of your vile and dangerous life.
Damn you, Holmes! Cried the Count with blazing eyes. There are limits to my patience.
It's all here, Count. The real facts as to the death of old Mrs. Harold, who left you the Blymer estate, which you so rapidly gambled away.
You are dreaming!
And the complete life history of Miss Minnie Warrender.
Chuck, you'll make nothing of that.
Plenty more here, Count. Here is the robbery in the Train de Luxe to the Riviera on February the 13th, 1892. Here is the forged check in the same year on the Crédit Lyonnais.
No, you're wrong there.
Then I am right on the others. Now, Count, you are a card player. When the other fellow has all the trumps, it saves time to throw down your hand.
What has all this talk to do with the jewel of which you spoke?
Gently, Count, restrain that eager mind. Let me get to the points in my own humdrum fashion. I have all this against you, but above all, I have a clear case against both you and your fighting bully in the case of the Crown Diamond.
Indeed.
I have the cabman who took you to Whitehall, and the cabman who brought you away. I have the commissionaire who saw you near the case. I have Ikey Sanders, who refused to cut it up for you. Ikey has peached, and the game is up. The veins stood out on the Count's forehead. His dark, hairy hands were clenched in a convulsion of restrained emotion. He tried to speak, but the words would not shape themselves. "That's the hand I play from," said Holmes. "I put it all upon the table. But one card is missing. It's the King of Diamonds. I don't know where the stone is."
"You shall never know."
"No? Now be reasonable. Can't consider the situation. You are going to be locked up for 20 years. So is Sam Merton. What good are you going to get out of your diamond? None in the world. But if you hand it over, well, I'll compound a felony. We don't want you or Sam. We want the stone. Give that up, and so far as I'm concerned, you can go free so long as you behave yourself in the future. If you make another slip, well, it will be the last. But this time, my commission is to get the stone, not you."
"But if I refuse?"
"Why then, alas, it must be you and not the stone." Billy had appeared in answer to a ring. "I think, Count, that it would be as well to have your friend Sam at this conference. After all, his interests should be represented. Billy, you will see a large and ugly gentleman outside the front door. Ask him to come up." "If he won't come, sir?" "No violence, Billy. Don't be rough with him. If you tell him that Count Silvius wants him, he will certainly come."
"What are you going to do now?"
asked the Count as Billy disappeared. "My friend Watson was with me just now. I told him that I had a shark and a gudgeon in my net. Now I am drawing the net, and up they come together." The Count had risen from his chair, and his hand was behind his back. Holmes held something half protruding from the pocket of his dressing gown.
"You won't die in your bed, Holmes."
"I have often had the same idea. Does it matter very much? After all, Count, your own exit is more likely to be perpendicular than horizontal. But these anticipations of the future are morbid. Why not give ourselves up to the unrestrained enjoyment of the present?" A sudden wild-beast light sprang up in the dark, menacing eyes of the master criminal. Holmes's figure seemed to grow taller as he grew tense and ready. "It's no use your fingering your revolver, my friend," he said in a quiet voice. "You know perfectly well that you dare not use it, even if I gave you time to draw it. Nasty, noisy things, revolvers, Count. Better stick to air-guns." "Ah, I think I hear the fairy footstep of your estimable partner. Good day, Mr. Merton. Rather dull in the street, is it not?" The prize-fighter, a heavily built young man with a stupid, obstinate, slab-sided face, stood awkwardly at the door, looking about him with a puzzled expression. Holmes's debonair manner was a new experience, and though he vaguely felt that it was hostile, he did not know how to counter it. He turned to his more astute comrade for help.
"What's the game now, Count? What's this fellow want? What's up?"
His voice was deep and raucous.
The Count shrugged his shoulders, and it was Holmes who answered.
"If I may put it in a nutshell, Mr. Merton, I should say it was all up."
The boxer still addressed his remarks to his associate.
"Is this cove trying to be funny or what? I'm not in the funny mood myself."
"No, I expect not," said Holmes. "I think I can promise you that you will feel even less humorous as the evening advances. Now look here, Count Silvius, I'm a busy man, and I can't waste time. I'm going into that bedroom. Pray make yourselves quite at home in my absence. You can explain to your friend how the matter lies without the restraint of my presence. I shall try over the Hoffmann Baccarol upon my violin. In 5 minutes I shall return for your final answer. You quite grasp the alternative, do you not? Shall we take you, or shall we have the stone?" Holmes withdrew, picking up his violin from the corner as he passed. A few moments later, the long-drawn, wailing notes of that most haunting of tunes came faintly through the closed door of the bedroom.
"What is it, then?"
asked Merton anxiously as his companion turned to him.
"Does he know about the stone?"
"He knows a damn sight too much about it. I'm not sure that he doesn't know all about it."
"Good Lord!"
The boxer's sallow face turned a shade whiter.
"Ikey Sanders has split on us."
"Yes, has he?
I'll do him down a ficken for that if I swing for it."
"That won't help us much. We've got to make up our minds what to do."
"Off a mo,"
said the boxer, looking suspiciously at the bedroom door.
"He's a leery cove that wants watching. I suppose he's not listening."
"How can he be listening with that music going?"
"Well, it's right.
Maybe somebody's behind a curtain.
Too many curtains in this room."
As he looked round, he suddenly saw for the first time the effigy in the window, and stood staring and pointing, too amazed for words.
"Tut, it's only a dummy," said the Count.
"A fake, is it? Oh, strike me, Madame Tussaud ain't in it. It's the living spit of him, gown and all. But them curtains, Count."
"Oh, confound the curtains. We're wasting our time, and there is none too much. He can lag us over this stone."
"The deuce he can."
"But he'll let us slip if we only tell him where the swag is."
"What?
Give it up? Give up 100,000 quid?
"It's one or the other."
Merton scratched his short-cropped pate.
"He's alone in there. Let's do him in. If his light were out, we should have nothing to fear."
The Count shook his head.
"He is armed and ready. If we shot him, we could hardly get away in a place like this. Besides, it's likely enough that the police know whatever evidence he has got. Hello? What was that?"
There was a vague sound which seemed to come from the window. Both men sprang round, but all was quiet. Save for the one strange figure seated in the chair, the room was certainly empty.
"Something in the street," said Merton. "Now look here, Governor. You've got the brains. Surely you can think a way out of it. If slugging is no use, then it's up to you."
"I've fooled better men than he," the Count answered.
"The stone is here in my secret pocket, and I take no chances leaving it about. It can be out of England tonight and cut into 4 pieces in Amsterdam before Sunday. He knows nothing of Vansedar."
"I thought Vansedar was going next week."
"He was, but now he must get off by the next boat. One or other of us must slip round with the stone to Lime Street and tell him."
"But the false bottom ain't ready."
"Well, he must take it as it is and chance it. There's not a moment to lose."
Again, with the sense of danger which becomes an instinct with the sportsman, he paused and looked hard at the window. Yes, it was surely from the street that the faint sound had come.
"As to Holmes," he continued, "we can fool him easily enough. You see, the damn fool won't arrest us if he can get the stone. Well, we'll promise him the stone. We'll put him on the wrong track about it. And before he finds that it is the wrong track, it will be in Holland and we out of the country."
"It sounds good to me," cried Sam Merton with a grin.
"You go on and tell the Dutchman to get a move on him."
I'll see this sucker and fill him up with a bogus confession. I'll tell him that the stone is in Liverpool. Confound that whining music, it gets on my nerves. By the time he finds it isn't in Liverpool, it will be in quarters and we on the blue water. Come back here, out of a line with that keyhole. Here is the stone. I wonder you dare carry it. Where could I have it safer? If we could take it out of Whitehall, someone else could surely take it out of my lodgings. Let's have a look at it.
Count Silvius cast a somewhat unflattering glance at his associate and disregarded the unwashed hand which was extended towards him.
What, do you think I'm going to snatch it off you? See here, mister, I'm getting a bit tired of your ways.
Well, well, no offence, Sam. We can't afford to quarrel. Come over to the window if you want to see the beauty properly. Now, hold it to the light. Here.
Thank you.
With a single spring, Holmes had leaped from the dummy's chair and had grasped the precious jewel. He held it now in one hand, while his other pointed a revolver at the Count's head. The two villains staggered back in utter amazement. Before they had recovered, Holmes had pressed the electric bell.
No violence, gentlemen, no violence, I beg of you. Consider the furniture. It must be very clear to you that your position is an impossible one. The police are waiting below.
The Count's bewilderment overmastered his rage and fear.
But how the deuce? He gasped.
Your surprise is very natural. You are not aware that a second door from my bedroom leads behind that curtain. I fancy that you must have heard me when I displaced the figure, but luck was on my side. It gave me a chance of listening to your racy conversation, which would have been painfully constrained had you been aware of my presence.
The Count gave a gesture of resignation. We give you best, Holmes. I believe you are the devil himself.
Not far from him, at any rate, Holmes answered with a polite smile. Sam Merton's slow intellect had only gradually appreciated the situation. Now, as the sound of heavy steps came from the stairs outside, he broke silence at last.
"A fair cop," said he. "But I say, what about that blooming fiddle? I hear it yet."
"Tut-tut," Holmes answered. "You are perfectly right. Let it play. These modern gramophones are a remarkable invention." There was an inrush of police, the handcuffs clicked, and the criminals were led to the waiting cab. Watson lingered with Holmes, congratulating him upon this fresh leaf added to his laurels. Once more their conversation was interrupted by the imperturbable Billy with his card tray.
"Lord Cantlemere, sir."
"Show him up, Billy. This is the eminent peer who represents the very highest interests," said Holmes. "He is an excellent and loyal person, but rather of the old regime. Shall we make him unbend? Dare we venture upon a slight liberty? He knows, we may conjecture, nothing of what has occurred." The door opened to admit a thin, austere figure with a hatchet face and drooping mid-Victorian whiskers of a glossy blackness, which hardly corresponded with the rounded shoulders and feeble gait. Holmes advanced affably and shook an unresponsive hand. "How do you do, Lord Cantlemere? It is chilly for the time of year, but rather warm indoors. May I take your overcoat?"
"No, I thank you. I will not take it off."
Holmes laid his hand insistently upon the sleeve. "Pray allow me. My friend Dr. Watson would assure you that these changes of temperature are most insidious." His lordship shook himself free with some impatience.
"I am quite comfortable, sir. I have no need to stay. I have simply looked in to know how your self-appointed task was progressing."
"It is difficult, very difficult."
"I fear that you would find it so."
There was a distinct sneer in the old courtier's words and manner.
"Every man finds his limitations, Mr. Holmes. but at least it cures us of the weakness of self-satisfaction. Yes, sir, I have been much perplexed, no doubt. Especially upon one point. Possibly you could help me. You apply for my advice rather late in the day. I thought that you had your own all-sufficient methods. Still, I am ready to help you. You see, Lord Cantlemere, we can no doubt frame a case against the actual thieves, when you have caught them. Exactly. But the question is, how shall we proceed against the receiver? Is this not rather premature? It is as well to have our plans ready. Now, what would you regard as final evidence against the receiver? The actual possession of the stone. You would arrest him upon that? Most undoubtedly. Holmes seldom laughed, but he got as near it as his old friend Watson could remember. In that case, my dear sir, I shall be under the painful necessity of advising your arrest. Lord Cantlemere was very angry. Some of the ancient fires flickered up into his sallow cheeks. You take a great liberty, Mr. Holmes. In 50 years of official life, I cannot recall such a case. I'm a busy man, sir, engaged upon important affairs, and I have no time or taste for foolish jokes. I may tell you frankly, sir, that I have never been a believer in your powers, and that I have always been of the opinion that the matter was far safer in the hands of the regular police force. Your conduct confirms all my conclusions. I have the honour, sir, to wish you good evening. Holmes had swiftly changed his position and was between the peer and the door. One moment, sir, said he. To actually go off with the Mazarin stone would be a more serious offence than to be found in temporary possession of it. Sir, this is intolerable. Let me pass. Put your hand in the right-hand pocket of your overcoat. What do you mean, sir? Come, come, do what I ask. An instant later, the amazed peer was standing, blinking and stammering, with the great yellow stone on his shaking palm. What? What? How is this, Mr. Holmes? Too bad, Lord Cantlemere, too bad, cried Holmes. My old friend here will tell you that I have an impish habit of practical joking, also that I can never resist a dramatic situation. I took the liberty, the very great liberty, I admit, of putting the stone into your pocket at the beginning of our interview. The old peer stared from the stone to the smiling face before him. Sir, I am bewildered, but yes, it is indeed the Mazarin stone. We are greatly your debtors, Mr. Holmes. Your sense of humour may, as you admit, be somewhat perverted, and its exhibition remarkably untimely, but at least I withdraw any reflection I have made upon your amazing professional powers. But how? The case is but half finished. The details can wait. No doubt, Lord Cantlemere, your pleasure in telling of this successful result in the exalted circle to which you return will be some small atonement for my practical joke. Billy, you will show his lordship out, and tell Mrs. Hudson that I should be glad if she would send up dinner for two as soon as possible.
The Problem of Thor Bridge. Somewhere in the vaults of the Bank of Cox and Company at Charing Cross, there is a travel-worn and battered tin dispatch box with my name, John H. Watson, M.D., late Indian Army, painted upon the lid. It is crammed with papers, nearly all of which are records of cases to illustrate the curious problems which Mr. Sherlock Holmes had at various times to examine. Some, and not the least interesting, were complete failures, and as such will hardly bear narrating, since no final explanation is forthcoming. A problem without a solution may interest the student, but can hardly fail to annoy the casual reader. Among these unfinished tales is that of Mr. James Phillimore,
who, stepping back into his own house to get his umbrella, was never more seen in this world. No less remarkable is that of the cutter Alicia, which sailed one spring morning into a small patch of mist from where she never again emerged, nor was anything further ever heard of herself and her crew. A third case worthy of note is that of Isadora Persano, the well-known journalist and duelist, who was found stark staring mad with a matchbox in front of him which contained a remarkable worm said to be unknown to science. Apart from these unfathomed cases, there are some which involve the secrets of private families to an extent which would mean consternation in many exalted quarters if it were thought possible that they might find their way into print. I need not say that such a breach of confidence is unthinkable, and that these records will be separated and destroyed now that my friend has time to turn his energies to the matter. There remain a considerable residue of cases of greater or less interest, which I might have edited before, had I not feared to give the public a surfeit which might react upon the reputation of the man whom, above all others, I revere. In some I was myself concerned, and can speak as an eyewitness, while in others I was either not present, or played so small a part that they could only be told as by a third person. The following narrative is drawn from my own experience. It was a wild morning in October, and I observed as I was dressing how the last remaining leaves were being whirled from the solitary plane tree which graces the yard behind our house. I descended to breakfast, prepared to find my companion in depressed spirits, for, like all great artists, he was easily impressed by his surroundings. On the contrary, I found that he had nearly finished his meal, and that his mood was particularly bright and joyous, with that somewhat sinister cheerfulness which was characteristic of his lighter moments. "You have a case, Holmes?" I remarked. "The faculty of deduction is certainly contagious, Watson," he answered. "It has enabled you to probe my secret. Yes, I have a case." After a month of trivialities and stagnation, the wheels move once more. Might I share it? There is little to share, but we may discuss it when you have consumed the two hard-boiled eggs with which our new cook has favoured us. Their condition may not be unconnected with the copy of the Family Herald, which I observed yesterday upon the hall table. Even so trivial a matter as cooking an egg demands an attention which is conscious of the passage of time and incompatible with the love romance in that excellent periodical. A quarter of an hour later, the table had been cleared, and we were face to face. He had drawn a letter from his pocket. "You have heard of Neil Gibson, the Gold King?" he said. "You mean the American senator?" "Well, he was once senator for some western state, but is better known as the greatest gold-mining magnate in the world." "Yes, I know of him. He has surely lived in England for some time. His name is very familiar." "Yes, he bought a considerable estate in Hampshire some 5 years ago. Possibly you have already heard of the tragic end of his wife?" "Of course.